All right, so we're diving into a pretty big one today.
Definitely a landmark case.
This is Eisenstadt v. Baird.
Right.
From 1972.
That's right, 1972.
Yeah, and even though it's over 50 years old at this point, it still has a major impact on discussions about reproductive rights and, you know, individual freedom.
Oh, absolutely. Huge implications even today.
And you send over some really great material on it, excerpts from the legal decisions and a case brief, even a podcast guide.
Well, I thought this would be helpful to kind of give us some context and different perspectives.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. So let's jump in and see what we can learn from all this.
Sounds good to me.
So maybe you could start us off by setting the scene. Mm-hmm. What was going on back then that led to this case even ending up in the Supreme Court?
Okay, so picture this. It's 1967. Right. We're at Boston University.
All right, I'm there.
And there's this guy, William Baird, a pretty well-known advocate for reproductive rights.
Okay.
He's giving a lecture about contraception.
Makes sense.
But here's where it gets interesting. He doesn't just talk about it. He actually shows contraceptives to the audience.
Oh, wow.
And even gives a sample of vaginal foam to an unmarried woman.
Bold move. Especially back then.
Right. Huge deal.
Yeah, I bet.
Because at the time, Massachusetts law was incredibly strict about all that.
Like, who could distribute contraceptives and stuff?
Exactly. Only doctors or pharmacists could.
And even then, there were limits.
Right. Big time. They can only give them to married couples.
So Baird was really putting himself out there, challenging that law head on.
Oh, absolutely. He knew he was pushing the boundaries.
And it sounds like his actions really forced the court to grapple with some fundamental questions about the Constitution.
For sure. Like, one of the biggest ones was whether the Massachusetts law violated the 14th Amendment.
Equal Protection Clause.
Right, exactly. Because the law treated married and unmarried people differently when it came to contraception.
So the court had to decide if that difference in treatment was justified.
Yeah. Did the state have a good enough reason to make that distinction?
I'm assuming the state tried to defend their law, though, right?
Oh, they definitely did. They had a couple of main arguments.
Why were those?
They claimed that contraceptives required medical supervision, for one thing.
Okay, so kind of a public health argument.
Right. And then they also leaned heavily on the idea that the law was meant to discourage premarital sex.
So basically, they were trying to use the law to enforce a particular moral viewpoint.
Yeah, you could say that.
But the court didn't buy it right.
Not really. They scrutinized those arguments and ultimately found them unconvincing.
Like, how so?
Well, for example, the type of contraceptive Baird gave out was considered safe. Didn't need a doctor's supervision.
Ah, so that kind of poked holes in their first argument.
Exactly. And when it came to the morality argument, the court basically said the government can't just use the law to push its own moral views.
Yeah.
Especially not when it comes to such personal decisions.
Right. That seems like a pretty important principle.
It is. It sets some real limits on government power.
It's fascinating to see how the court tackled those issues. But there's another piece to this legal puzzle, isn't there?
You're talking about standing.
Yeah. Could Baird even bring this case in the first place? I mean, he was a married man challenging a law that discriminated against unmarried people.
That's a really good point. And it was a key issue in the case. Typically, you can only challenge a law if it directly harms you.
So how did Baird have standing?
The court made an interesting exception in this case.
Okay, what was that?
They recognized that the law directly harmed unmarried individuals. And since Baird was prosecuted for giving contraception to an unmarried woman, they said he had a right to argue on their behalf.
So the court basically said that Baird's prosecution was tied to the rights of unmarried people.
Right, because the law was being used to restrict their access to contraception.
So that opened the door for the court to address the bigger question about whether the right to privacy should apply to everyone married or not.
Precisely. That's where Griswold v. Connecticut comes in.
Right. That case established the right to contraception for married couples.
Exactly. And so Eisenstadt built on that.
It took that idea of privacy and broadened it to include all individuals.
Right. It was a big step forward in terms of recognizing individual autonomy.
And that's where Justice Brennan's famous quote comes in, right?
You know, if the right of privacy means anything, it is the right of the individual, married or single, to be free from unwarranted governmental intrusion into matters so fundamentally affecting a person as the decision whether to bear or beget a child.
It's a powerful statement about the right to make personal choices without the government interfering.
Absolutely.
But even though the majority of the court agreed with Baird, it wasn't a unanimous decision, right? There were some dissenting opinions.
That's right. Not everyone was on board with this expansion of privacy rights.
So what were the justices who disagreed with the majority concerned about?
Well, for starters, the main dissent was led by Chief Justice Berger, and he argued that states should have more power, you know, to regulate things like contraceptives, which they considered medicinal products.
So he was basically saying the majority opinion was overstepping.
Yeah, like they were intruding on an area that should be left up to the states.
Right, so it's that classic debate about federal power versus states' rights.
It definitely comes up a lot in constitutional law, for sure.
It does. It's interesting, though, that even the dissent in Eisenschott didn't completely reject the idea of a right to privacy when it comes to reproduction.
Yeah, that's true. They weren't saying there's no right to privacy at all.
So what was their main concern then?
I think they were more worried about how broadly the court was interpreting that.
Like they're saying, okay,
yeah,
maybe there's a right to privacy here, but let's not go too far in limiting the state's ability to regulate things.
Exactly. It's a nuanced disagreement, you know.
It shows how even within the court, there can be different perspectives on how to balance individual rights with the government's role.
It's not always black and white.
Definitely not.
Yeah.
But ultimately, the majority's decision in Eisenschott did expand the scope of privacy rights.
And it's had a huge impact on later cases dealing with reproductive freedom.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And it's impossible to talk about Eisenschott without mentioning Roe v. Wade.
Right, which came just a year later.
It's like Eisenschott laid the groundwork for the right to abortion by establishing that individuals have a fundamental right to make decisions about their reproductive lives.
Yeah, it set a precedent that the government can't just interfere with those choices.
It's like Eisenstadt built a bridge to Roe v. Wade.
That's a great way to put it. And that bridge extends even further, reaching into contemporary debates about access to things like Plan B or in vitro fertilization, even gender-affirming care.
Wow. Okay, so let's explore that a bit. How has Eisenstadt influenced access to emergency contraception?
Well, think about the arguments that are sometimes made against making Plan B easily available.
Like that it encourages risky sexual behavior.
Exactly. But Eisenschott pushes back on that kind of thinking, you know?
Like it says the government can't just impose its moral views on individuals.
Right. Especially when it comes to personal choices about their reproductive health.
So Eisenschott basically provides a legal basis for arguing that people should have access to emergency contraception without all these restrictions based on moral judgments.
Exactly. And that same logic can be applied to discussions about IVF.
Right. IVF helps people who have trouble conceiving have children.
But it can be a complicated process. Expensive, too.
And there are some who want more government regulation of it, right?
Yeah, citing concerns about potential risks and ethical issues.
And wouldn't that go against what Eisenschott established? I mean, if people have a fundamental right to decide whether to have children, shouldn't that include the right to use technologies that help them do that?
That's a key argument made by those who support broader access to IVF.
Hmm.
They see Eisenschott as a legal precedent that protects people from excessive government intrusion into their reproductive choices.
So it's not just about contraception, it's about the right to use assisted reproductive technologies as well.
Exactly. And it shows how a case from 1972 is still relevant to these modern debates about reproductive technology.
It really is amazing to see that connection. But you mentioned gender-affirming care, too. How does Eisenschott relate to that?
Well, that's where the broader implications of Eisenschott's emphasis on individual autonomy come into play.
So we're not just talking about reproduction in the traditional sense.
Right. It's about people having the right to make choices about their own bodies and identities.
Including their gender identity.
Exactly. And proponents of gender-affirming care argue that Eisenschott supports the right of transgender individuals to access medical treatments that align with their gender identity.
Like hormone therapy or gender confirmation surgery.
Exactly. They see attempts to restrict access to those treatments as a violation of people's right to make their own medical decisions.
So it's about the government overstepping its bounds and interfering with individual autonomy.
Right. And they point to Eisenschott as a precedent that protects against that kind of overreach.
It's incredible how a case that focused specifically on contraception has had such a broad impact on these other areas.
It's a testament to the power of legal precedent and to the enduring importance of individual rights.
It really is. So while Eisenschott may have started with contraception, its legacy goes way beyond that.
It's become a touchstone for arguments about individual autonomy and the right to make choices about one's own body and healthcare.
Regardless of societal norms or moral judgments.
Exactly. It's about respecting individual freedom and the right to self-determination.
Yeah.
Yeah, it really makes you think.
It does. You know, it's like these legal battles aren't just happening in some abstract vacuum.
Right, they have real consequences.
Yeah, they shape people's lives, their freedoms.
Absolutely. And Aizasha is such a good example of that.
It started with a lecture about contraception.
And it's had this ripple effect, you know.
Reaching into all these other areas.
Touching on the right to make choices about our families, our bodies, our identities.
It's really pretty remarkable.
It is. It shows how legal precedents can create this momentum for change.
So as we're dealing with all these ongoing debates about reproductive rights, access to healthcare, even the very idea of individual autonomy, what lessons can we learn from Eisenstadt?
That's a good
Like, what
question.
does it tell us about finding that balance between personal freedom and the interests of society?
Well, I think one of the key takeaways is that we have to recognize the dignity and autonomy of each person.
Right.
Eisenstadt rejected the idea that the government can just impose its moral code on everyone.
Especially when it comes to these really personal decisions.
Exactly. So it's a reminder that personal freedom is essential for a just society.
But I'm also wondering, where do we draw the line? Does the government have any role in regulating personal choices, or should we leave those decisions completely up to the individual?
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it?
It seems like it.
And it's one we're still debating today. Even in Eisenstadt itself, the justices had different opinions about how far the right to privacy extends and where the government's power should stop.
Yeah, it's complex.
It is, and we're still figuring it out as a society.
Finding that balance between individual freedom and the common good.
Right. This is an ongoing process.
Eisenstadt doesn't give us all the answers, but it does give us a framework for thinking about these tough issues.
I think that's a good way to put it.
It encourages us to really look critically at laws that might infringe on individual autonomy.
And it reminds us that we have to keep fighting for these rights.
You can't take them for granted.
Exactly. We have to be aware of how they're being affected by new laws and by changes in society.
That's a great point. So for everyone listening, as you're thinking about these issues, reproductive freedom, healthcare, individual rights, remember Eisenstadt v. Baird.
It's a landmark case for a reason.
Ask yourselves, where do we draw that line between what individuals should be free to decide and what the government has a role in?
It's a crucial question.
One that deserves careful thought and discussion.
Absolutely.
Well said. Well, this has been another fascinating deep dive.
It has. It's always great to dig into these impactful cases.
Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And thanks to everyone for listening. We'll be back next time with another deep dive into a topic that matters. So be sure to tune in.